Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Magical World of G. Michael Vasey. Today I'm really pleased to be able to welcome a special guest, Alan Richardson. Alan has been writing weird, wonderful, winsome, and frequently embarrassing books for longer than many of his readers have been alive. He's done biographies of such luminaries as Dion Fortune, Aleister Crowley, Christine Hartley, William Gray, and his own grandfather, plus novels and novellas that are all set in his local area with accompanying scripts. He has a deep interest in earth mysteries, mythology, paganism, Celtic lore, ancient Egypt, jet fighters, army tanks, Wiltshire tea shops, great British actors and Newcastle United Football Club. He says he doesn't belong to any group or society and he doesn't take pupils because most of the time he hasn't got a clue what's going on. I doubt that's true, but Alan's sense of humour is renowned. I've been reading many of his books recently. The Sea Priest and Dark Magery are a couple of his books that I've read recently, and he has a very homely way of looking at magic, and he keeps it simple. So I was delighted to be able to speak with Alan. Here is Alan Richardson.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, let's say there was always a sense of kind of otherness in my life right from the time I was a child. I was sort of, when I was perhaps about five in infant school, I suppose I had a kind of benign possession. It's very hard to describe. And I was sitting in, I was in the playground, and my big sister was in the big girls' school, and they were playing hockey. I was an infant, so I must have been about five. I just started school. And it seemed as if the world stopped. Again, that's very hard to describe. People use that term in books now, but it's like the world stopped. I was aware of everything going on, yet I was sort of taken over as if this being possessed me in a very benign way that is essentially feminine in nature that came down and pushed little me, Alan, to the back of my skull and was watching while my big sister was playing hockey in the schoolyard there. This has happened to me several times after that when I was much younger. Stopping the world, I think Carlos Castaneda called it, and I know exactly what he means in perhaps a slightly different context. So it is always there. And again, as a child, I was quite a weird child, really. I used to read about, of course, King Arthur and his knights and the whole Holy Grail thing. And I was outraged at the time when I was five or six. I must have read Roger Lancelin Green's books about King Arthur and his knights, when the wonderful Lancelot was denied the mysteries of the Holy Grail. He was the only one who denied it because he wasn't chaste.
Yes.
And I didn't understand that. I was only 5 or 6 years old. You know, I had to ask my mum, "Ma'am, what does chaste mean?" "Oh, didn't I know that, man?" I thought, what? So I always felt that it's a bit unfair, the whole Holy Grail thing. And I still think it's a bit unfair. He was robbed, was Lancelot, or Dulac, as he seemed to come through to me many years later. It is something that was omnipresent in my life, Gary, but I had to keep very quiet about it. There was no one I knew up there. My mother was terrified of it. I realized much later she was terrified of it because her mother, whom I never met, was Fay. And also, I'm a coal miner's son. It is an entire coal mining community. We didn't have any overt religious sense there at all. For example, I never knew anyone, none of my pals at school, right the way through school from 5 to the age of 18, I never knew anyone who went to church. I'm sure there must have been someone that actually did go to church, other than to get married or funerals. But I never knew a single one of them. So it is not religious. And then sometime in about the age, oh, goodness me, I stumbled upon the books. Oh, Dennis Wheatley, of course, we all went through that phase, you know, the black magic thing and everything like that.
The Devil Rides Out.
The Devil Rides Out, which terrified the life out of me. And then sometime probably before that, well, I think I must have been about 14, I stumbled upon a book in Iraq that called out to me, and it was Lobsang Rampa's You Forever, which absolutely hit me like a sledgehammer, you know, a how-to techniques and astral projection, clairvoyance, and all the rest of it. And I was absolutely shaking when I looked at that and the pictures inside. I thought there was a side of me, I knew this, I know this. Mm-hmm. And of course, Lobsang Rampa, we all know now, his real name was Cyril Hoskins from Thames Ditton in Surrey. he had never been nearer Lhasa than Surbiton in Surrey. But that didn't matter. I quite liked, I like rascal gurus, Gary. The more rascally, the better, as long as they don't hurt anyone. I've got a great fondness for them, thanks to Lobsang Rampa. So even though he's a rascal, it doesn't mean to say that what he was teaching in his books was wrong. And then later on, of course, as I explained in my little book, me, myself, and Dionne Fortune, I stumbled into this woman called Dionne Fortune and her writings. And again, it was like putting on an old overcoat. It just felt right and comfortable. And I was totally obsessed by it. It is omnipresent within me. Yet I didn't want to seem too overtly weird. I had to live a normal life with, normal lads and lasses and up in Ashington. I remember watching television once, and David Frost was having some program about something quite coincidental or whatever. And one of the people in the audience said they believed in reincarnation. The whole audience burst out laughing at what a ridiculous thing. I mean, who would do that these days? So me and my interest in magic, of course, I had to keep very, very quiet. And even it's only fairly recently that I sorted, I can, in a sense, come out of my own closet, magically speaking. Of course, in the many jobs I've had, people would sometimes suss that there's another side to me. But again, I didn't really like to bang on about it. I just wanted to live a normal life and carry on writing these books, many of which embarrassed me at the time, and I'd get rid of them, put them in the upper room and hide them, and have nothing else to do with them.
You also did something quite intriguing, which is you actually reached out to some of these magical characters at the time, didn't you, and wrote to them and engaged them in conversation.
Gosh, I wrote all over the place, Gary. I had to be very secretive about it because, again, my ma'am, God bless her, she was terrified about it. So I wrote to Lobsang Rampa. I've got letters from him. I wrote to William G. Gray. I wrote to W.E. Butler. You name them, I wrote to everyone at that time, a lot of people whom no one will ever heard of. I had to be very secretive. I had to break the spring of the lock of the letterbox so it didn't make a noise. And I'd have to sneak downstairs in the morning when the postie came, I'd quietly get through the letters and sneak upstairs and sort of read them and carry on a secretive correspondence like that. Yeah, I got a massive, I've got boxes full of letters from, I mark it on the bottom of my wardrobe, letters from the Magi, because, they're all sorts of people from all sorts. Israel Regardi, of course, and you name it, I've had letters from them. Piles from the lovely, wonderful, sexy and funny Dolores Ashcroft Novici. May her name be blessed. I love Dolores. And one day, if anybody wants to make something wonderful with them, then if they make a good case to me, prove their merit, they can do something with this massive, brilliant letters I've got from her.
I've read a lot of your books. I'm reading one of your classics right now called Sex and Light and having a right giggle with it. You seem to make this point that you're a solo practitioner. So I wanted to ask, have you ever been a part of a magical group, or have you always tended to be a solo practitioner?
Well, no, solo practitioner. You see, when I was a lad growing up, I would have given anything to join a group, absolutely anything to join a group. But there didn't seem to be any up there in Northumberland and Newcastle, Ashington area. So it was, the solo thing was sort of forced upon me. I had the opportunity to join William Gray's group, but I didn't. And I can't tell you why I didn't want to. I don't suppose I particularly found his type of magic, his seasonal occult rituals, appealing. And Bill Gray was a difficult sort of character. Yeah. And like anyone else, he banned me from his house and, banished me from his place. And later on, he invited me back. Have I ever wanted to join a group? No. I always felt that it was powers that be kept me away from them. And at the time, I was frustrated because I wanted to find true love and happiness. I wanted to find a young, sexy priestess that I could live happily ever after with. And and I was sort of 55 before I actually found this with my wife now, Margaret. Have I ever wanted to join a group? I have envied it, Gary. And I looked on, and circumstances seemed to have kept me away from it. I've had a little dalliance with a little group in connection with the lovely Suzanne Ruthven, but I was never really part and parcel of it. I was just a sort of dap my head in and out, sort of saying hello and goodbye. So I have enormous respect for groups. I have an enormous love and fascination for, you know, Dolores, of course, and a kinship. Of course, I demanded initiation from Kenneth Grant. I wrote letters to him, demanded initiation when I was about 17, because it says in the Book of the Law you can do that. I can't remember what exactly verse in the Book of the Law says you can do this. So I said that to him, and he sent a letter back saying, no, you know, you got to do a bit of work first and a bit of... What? Doing a bit of work, for goodness sake.
I read your books, and obviously a lot of knowledge and expertise shines through those things. And it's difficult for me to understand how you arrived at that without ever undertaking some formal correspondence course and doing the whole thing. Unless, of course, the experiences that you talk about when you were a small child have something to do with it, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's, shall we say, otherness, magic in the broader sense. It is omnipresent within me, Gary, and my God, that's not a boast, the burdens that has put upon me. And also, you and I did not know the internet when we were growing up. We did not have the you know, the wonders of Google and things like that, as youngsters have these days. But I bet you experienced a library angel. I bet there have been times when you've walked into a library and books that you just needed, like a witchcraft book, almost flung themselves at you. Yeah. And, you know, to an extent, they still do now. And the most appropriate books in the most bizarre places, think, what the hell is that doing here? You know. And so I've always been a voracious reader. Oh, I don't like to bang on too much about past lives because I make no big cult about past lives. But when I started reading The Magic of Dionne Fortune and all of her stuff and that wonderful autobiography of her, Psychic Self-Defense, there's a side of me very deeply which said, I know this. Right. And the very first time I saw a picture of Dionne Fortune was in a book, which you might remember, called The New Dimensions Red Book. Mm-hmm. It is a collection of essays that Gareth Knight put together. It came out in the 60s. And that had the first picture of Dionne Fortune. And I was electrified by it. And my first impression was, I was there when that photograph was taken. How, I don't know. But I was there, and I felt this when I was a teenager. And it was not taken in Glastonbury. It was taken in a park in London. I'm certain of that. Somehow I was part of that group.
Right.
Either an echo, a past life. I make no judgment about past lives, Gary. I can't sort of really make any boasts or predictions or statements about that. But there's something that was sort of in my bones about the whole magical thing. But as I said, it's not a boast. My God, there are times when I'm thinking, leave me alone, please, please. Let me have a normal life and stop punishing me like this.
The thing that strikes me is with the interactions with all of these very larger-than-life magical characters over the years, what kind of an impression did these people give you? Because I'll tell you for why. Because outside of a couple of people that I've met in the magical arena, I've been remarkably unimpressed with the reality of the person. It's like I was expecting a powerful person to sweep into the room and have this aura, this mystical aura, and you meet them and they're just ordinary people. How did these people strike you, and what kind of an impression? Did anybody leave you with a strong impression of power and majesty?
I've had much the same experience as yourself, Gary. I you know, there are some who stand out. The wonderful Dolores, Christine Hartley, a couple of others whom I won't name that would be embarrassed if I did name them, have impressed me. But like yourself, I'm thinking, oh my goodness me, it's you expect some of these adepti to be, you know, front runners in the evolutionary race, and they actually seem very small and very puny almost. And I don't mean that as a kind of put down, but not impressive at all. And it's quite startling, really.
Then again, because
I've had so many jobs. One of my granddaughters asked me the other day, how many jobs have you had, Granddad? And I've had to count them all. I've had 22. And I've never wanted a career in any of them. You know, I've always just wanted to write, basically, and I've wanted to earn money to pay the support my family, etc., which I've managed to do. But during that, during all of this, I've met many people in my ordinary workaday business who ostensibly have absolutely no interest in the outer world of magic or whatever, make no noise about it, yet, my God, their inner life is something quite extraordinary. Yeah. One woman I worked with who shall be nameless and is one of my, as you'd say now, best friends forever, you would think she was, you know, empty, air-headed bimbo. And I've used that term to her face with deep loving cut. But my God, inside, in ways that nobody else will know except those very close to her and myself. You know, she spends half a life in the inner realms of Egypt and with extraordinary talents, extraordinary abilities. And sometimes that radiates through. And I've seen her at work in a job I had then, and she's not quite here, and she's doing all the job that she should be. And I said, you're in another place, aren't you? She says, yeah. And I've met a few people like that who don't go in, you know, who don't go overtly as occultists or magicians or whatever. And I've met loads of people who do make loads of noises about being, oh, my goodness me, Zen masters or Reiki masters and all of this and all of that. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness me, this. The more noise they make, the less power they have, I think, in some circumstances. I mean, Bill Gray had power. He terrified me. Absolutely. I was a young man, and I did not know what to make of him. So, as you know, I had lots of letters from him. From the time I was in my mid-teens. So I projected all sorts of qualities onto him of being what great adepts are like. And he had the power, which was quite abrasive, quite abrasive. And so I could never feel really totally comfortable with him. As I said, I was scared of him. I loved his wife, Bobby. She was a different soul altogether. But was I close to them in human terms? No. I tried to do my best for him in the biography, The Old Sod, that I wrote about him, which was based upon his own diaries. But I had to edit the diaries, edit his own autobiography quite severely, because some of it is quite nasty and some of it made him feel very small, which he was not small. And right. I never took to his Sangreal stuff at all. Absolutely not at all. I thought it was 100 years after its time. By and large, I'm glad I more or less keep to myself, come out of the closet every now and again for short periods of time and meet people for cups of tea in short periods of time and then escape.
Back to the real world.
I do envy the group thing, though, Gary. And the thing that I miss, I think, I would miss the gossip. I would miss the scandal and who's doing what to whom.
Oh, there's a lot of that.
There's never a lot of that. And I tend to have to get it secondhand through the biographies and autobiographies. And lots of things I know, I think, oh, I wish I could write about this just sometime, you know, and all sorts of things.
You're putting out quite a lot of books, and I love that, of course. But what drives you to write the books that you're writing now? Because they seem very much like a sort of magical diary published to some extent.
They are, Gary. It's I think with the Templar Door, in which I found a Templar Door a Templar Door at a church in the middle of nowhere in Wiltshire, and I decided to find out more about the Templars, whom various people in the Wiccan business sort of said hovered around me. And I started to write it as partly an exploration and partly a journal, and I carried on from there. I'm always writing. It's always in my head, Gary. If I can't, there's always something going on. And the last few books have been, I thought I might as well go and just do actual magical journals, you know, this particular date. I'm doing it today, even, the thing I'm writing now, and just see what comes. And like yourself with the hexagram book, I reach a state and I'm writing about a book which I call The Sea Priest, which is based upon something that, shall we call it a being, an energy, an entity, a myth that floated into my head out of nowhere. And it sort of tagged about with me, you know, over the next few weeks and few months. And I sort of quite enjoyed writing it. I never knew what was going to come the next day. I kept saying to my wife, Margaret, I says, well, I haven't a clue what's going to come next. But like yourself, it's not that I get any cosmic being or any Celtic priest from the 7th, 6th century St. Alan, you got to say, maybe I did. But I just sort of, let's just do this in a gentle sort of way. Yeah. I mean, I'm freed in the sense that via Amazon, I can self-publish. And I have to thank Judith Page for telling me the possibilities of that. I didn't know you could, and I can self-publish for nothing. I make bugger all money, Gary, from it. And I never have with any of my books. Pitiful. You would not believe how little I've earned in my books.
But oh, I can.
I have to get them. I have to do this writing and get it out there. It's my sort of, it's my magic. So it's always in my head. And once I finished, I usually have a whine and whinge, and I say to my wife, it's gone, oh. And she says, you always say that. It'll come back. And so far, it always has. I'm writing about ancient Egypt at the moment, but it's bizarrely, here it is. I'm writing about ancient Egypt, yet it's still tied in with my walks and explorations about the local landscape of Wiltshire, and my daily doings with the sparrows in my garden and the garden centre and the tea shops and cafes, yet somehow it's all about ancient Egypt, which sounds quite ridiculous and bizarre, but it seems to be working out quite happily.
You've certainly given me an example. I think you read Chasing the Shaman, and that,
yes,
that
I did. I enjoyed that.
Kind of,
yes,
came very much in the same way. And I'd read the Templar book and the Sea Priest book and a couple of your other books, and thought, I can sort of do that. And I got into it, and I got into the flow, and it's continued beyond. I mean, I'm now doing some other stuff, which probably will arrive as a book in 6 months' time with the Slavic gods here in the Czech Republic. So
yeah.
I want to thank you for showing an approach that is very intriguing.
Well, don't, Gary, because I'm going to steal from the Chasing the Shaman ruthlessly. You know, I've already quoted from it in the thing I'm doing now. So, you know,
I've ripped
into it and stolen it, and you know, you can sue me to buggery and future things. No, absolutely, it's a two-way thing. So I'm glad it did read well, and I like to read that. I like to read stories and yarns. I love people's yarns.
Yeah.
I don't want philosophies, basically. I want yarns and your stuff in Czechoslovakia is in this, you know, is quite unusual. And I like your yarns. I like your stories. I can see you telling the story, and I can see the events with this strange shaman that appeared in the streets near where you were. And I think, ooh, wow, that's the sort of thing I like to read about. I'm glad my stuff has inspired you like that. I mean, these things that float into my head, whatever they are, beings or energies or entities or parts of myself, are all the same. They take over me in some ways, in a subtle way. Then they bugger off. And, you know, I've often said to myself and to my wife, what the hell was all that about? You know, and good grief.
$6 million question. What is magic for Alan?
Oh, I have no idea. Absolutely no idea. You can give all the quotes. Just a sense of otherness. That's the most, like, everyone has a different sense of otherness. I use it in the very, very broadest sense. I think in writing the books, in one of them, the books, I said, you know, all the formal magicians have their magical names. We all have our own secret magical names. But the magicians of the Golden Dawn had their magical mottos, which were usually stolen, taken from their family names. And I decided, tongue-in-cheek, but effectively, I want mine to be Frater K-I-S-S, Frater Keep It Simple, Stupid. And I've tried to keep on writing like that, to keep it as simple as I can and not get dissolved, to disappear into hard, really hard technical intellectual writings. Mainly because I'm not an intellectual type. I'm very, very clever, but I'm not an intellectual.
What about the paranormal, the supernatural? Have you ever had an interest in that? Has it ever impinged upon your life? Does it somehow mix in with the magical stuff for you or not?
Oh, I'm always willing to read it, Gary. I'm a voracious reader about all sorts. So I'm very happy to read this. So all of the books that you will be able to quote, and your stuff as well, I will read and I absorb. And I think, I like to think, what's all that about? And, so have I had paranormal experiences? I'll have to have a think about that, how that verges from what I would call magical experiences. I probably just use the term magic for paranormal. Use the term magic in such a broad, broad sense.
That, me too.
Yes. So I am fascinated by it, absolutely. So if anyone's got any great stories, I will totally, totally absorb them. As I said, I'm always picking up books. I'm always reading, and books fling themselves at me, and they stick in my head. I will make use of that information at some point when I come to my own yarns and magical yarns. So it makes sense of things that happened within me, really, basically.
And what can we expect from Alan in the near future?
Well, I'm working on this book, as I said. I've just called it, at the moment, notionally, Khem, K-H-E-M, you know, the old name for Egypt.
Yeah.
And I'll see how that's. I'm about halfway through that. I like self-publishing because, it costs nothing. I could put all my own pictures in. I like putting little pictures in the text.
Mm-hmm.
And mainstream publishers, not the slightest interest in dealing with me at all. And the indie publishers struggling so hard, they can't afford to take any chance on something bizarre and as outre as that I'm writing. So basically, I just carry on writing. I'm happy in my life, Gary. I'm living the life I never wanted to work. I've always wanted to spend my life writing books on magic and, you know, being a good dad and being a good husband. And now that I've retired, I'm able to do that quite happily all the time. So my book on Khem, I hope to finish, I'm going on holiday at the Isle of Wight next week, thankfully, now that the lockdown is allowing that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime in the next couple of months, I'll finish that and I'll launch that. And then I'll whinge and say, oh, it's all gone. And Margaret will say, you always say that. And something else will come floating in. Hopefully that'll be it. And I look forward to your next one, set in Czechoslovakia. And I shall steal everything I can from that. I have stolen, I steal from everyone. I've stolen so much from Dolores in the past, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think she's realized how much I've stolen from her. And one day I'll give her full credit for that.
Oh, I'm sure she, in sympathy with you anyway, because as I understand it, she's now busy writing, and knocking out book after book after book and enjoying herself as well.
Oh, bless her. Absolutely bless. She is one of the people who often asked who is my teachers in magic. Christine Hartley. Bill Gray was an instructor in a differing sort of way, but I've learned more from Dolores, may her name be blessed, than anyone. And that's probably the greatest praise I can say about her.
My thanks to Alan Richardson for joining us today. Please do go and buy as many of his books as you can afford. They're all available on Amazon and Amazon UK, etc. I'll post details in the field below the podcast. And do come back and join us for the next edition, or indeed any of the back episodes of The Magical World of G. Michael Vasey. Once again, thank you. Goodbye.